On the Health Justice Radio program, we explore the ways in which social factors like housing status, income, and gender affect health outcomes. We understand that inequities in health are not the fault of random distribution of misfortune, but rather are the most physical reminder of systemic inequities. Children are particularly vulnerable to disruptions in their access to necessities like health care, proper nutrition, and a stable emotional environment, as they are in the process of developing physically, intellectually, and emotionally. Today, we will speak with a family lawyer to try to understand issues that children are facing and what is being done about it on the legal front. Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3. Jeffrey Wilson is a specialist in family law with over 30 years of practice. He earned his Juris Doctor from Osgoode Hall Law School and is presently an adjunct professor at the Faculty of Law, University of Toronto, teaching an advanced course on children and the law. Jeffrey is the recipient of the prestigious Advocacy Society Award of Justice, Lexpert top-tiered most frequently recommended family lawyer, and National Post best family lawyer mention. He is the founding partner of Wilson Christen LLP, author of the textbook Wilson on Children and the Law, and editor of the Ontario Family Law Reporter. Jeffrey currently leads the recently formed Law and Youth Taking Ownership of Knowledge workshops that enable the engagement of vulnerable youth with dedicated lawyers and judges. Hello, Mr. Wilson. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So I thought we'd start by asking about how the health and well-being of children might be compromised in cases that you see.
Well, the cases that I'm involved with are those where the license of being a parent, without committing any criminal offense or alleged to have committed a criminal offense, exposes children to remarkable vulnerabilities. Children can witness violence or repeated arguing conflict between their parents. Children can be placed, go through multiple placements, that is, lack stability as they are being raised. Children can be subject to one parent or both parents' influence so that they feel confined or deprived of an ordinary childhood, and so they spend most of their time practicing the piano or trying or hoping to become the best figure skater or whatever it is that forms the parents' aspirations for their child. So the license of being a parent, inherently places children vulnerable.
Right. So I guess a child can have the life that they're accustomed to, and then it will all of a sudden be disrupted, and that on its own can be particularly damaging.
Right. Where the level of tension or conflict, or where parents separate, go through a divorce, or there's other disruption in the home, then that is the number one concern, that the conflict in and of itself will cause harm to the child. Upheaval, the sense of loss, the sense of deprivation. If they go through multiple separations from a parent or both parents, then they lose a sense of attachment, of being able to trust or rely upon anybody, because whoever it is that they thought they could trust is no longer there. Simply witnessing violence, the kind of violence that isn't a crime, but is loud and angry and volatile, can result for the child growing up with a sense of mistrust, of always being on guard, worrying about others, worrying about themselves.
And how inevitable is this in the kinds of cases you see, for example, in a separation or where there's violence in the home? Is it always the case that the child's life is disrupted?
Nothing is always the case in the work I do, but the empirical evidence suggests that a child who witnesses violence, let alone a child who is exposed to being hurt as a result of a violent act by an older person, will go through great upheaval and will suffer, have long-term harm.
So
where there is a separation of great conflict, then the empirical evidence suggests that the conflict in and of itself is more harmful than any result. So it wouldn't matter which of the competing parents ended up with the child. It really wouldn't matter, because what harm we've done has been occasioned because the parents have been fighting so viciously for their child, in consequence of which the child loses a sense of self.
Right. So do you think there are any strategies that can sort of mitigate this damage, or is there particular outcomes that are better that you see because a certain strategy was used?
Well, strategies are being implemented. I think the family courts in Ontario, and in fact throughout Canada, are having to shift from being places where they simply solve a problem between parents in conflict to taking a more active or prophylactic position, in the sense of offering family information to families on the eve or about to engage in what we might call litigation or in conflict resolution. So there's a shift there by the courts. Lawyers are being trained, hopefully, differently, so that the first thing we don't think of is going to court or proceeding with litigation. Rather, we see whether there are other resources for helping the family solve the problem without becoming polarized. It's the polarization that gives rise to the awful conflict. And this does no good for children, and yet it seems to be, what's the word, there's an allurement or a tendency for parents to feel the need to carve out a position where each says, I know better than you what's in the best interest of my child.
Right. Would you say that it's just that the more severe cases go to court, or that the act of court, going to court, actually makes outcomes worse for the children and makes it harder on the children?
Yeah. In the cases about which we speak, the act of court is the disease in and of itself. It causes the harm.
Right. In these cases...
In fact, I'd go so far, Mr. Brown, to argue that in many of these cases, children would do better off if parents had no right to litigate over who owned the child. Rather, there are only two rules that govern. If they hurt one another, then the criminal law intervenes. And if they hurt their child, then the state child protection agencies intervene, and maybe they'll lose their child altogether.
So in almost every case, when the parents are exercising their rights, they're infringing on their children's?
In the cases about which we're mentioning, yes.
In these cases, are the parents conscious of the harm that they could be causing their children? Are they aware of it?
Well, I don't know. That's an area for someone else's domain. I think it's no different than states or nations. Whenever, or a religion in a way, it almost becomes religion in a sense, because it's a crusade. I'm not doing this out of concern for myself, says the father or the mother. I'm doing it because it's in the best interest of our child. I'm motivated to take these actions in order to rescue our child. Now, there may be cases of extreme violence where a court is necessary, but usually in those cases of extreme violence, the child protection or criminal authorities will intervene. And so, short of that kind of manifest disturbance or manifest oppression by one parent over the other, their dynamic, their dance is a nice way of putting it, is going to do more damage to the child than if they did nothing.
So even if the parents are aware that what they're doing might harm the children, they're still doing it in their name, so it's almost misguided.
It's what happens. It's in the best... The cardinal principle in the law that I would argue in another day causes in too many times more harm to the child than help, it's paradoxically the principle in the best interest of the child. Because the principle in the best interest of the child allows many things to happen that for the child are not in her best interest.
Right. So when you try to explain this situation to a parent, are they generally receptive or in denial?
I think the better professionals today take more time to impress upon their client that this isn't the way. Now, remember, there's a momentum for the lawyer or for parties in conflict to fight it out, is not the right word, but to go at it, so to speak. And so with greater education, the momentum has to be, no, we're not going to allow you to do that. We're going to institute, which we are going to, I think, in not too long, compulsory mediation, compulsory education, where probably parents, it's better that we have a referee. You go into a house, I'm going to give you an image now, and when you go into this house and you have to stay there with this referee to make sure nothing untoward happens to one of you, and you can't come out until you've solved this, and you have to talk directly to one another. One of the difficulties in the work I do in the law is that parents take on, or lawyers take on, the role of speaking vicariously for their clients. And even that assumption of responsibility by the lawyer is somewhat of a distraction, and it creates a problem, because who knows better the children than the parents? And in any event, they are the ones who have to work this out.
So even with the best intentions, once the legal machine gets going, there are casualties.
There are casualties.
Are there any kinds of government programs or organizations available to help children or to shine light on this situation?
Yes, there's a lot going on, and there are changes being made. There are legal aid clinics in Ontario. There's the Office of the Children's Lawyers. There's offices of child advocates throughout the country. There's helplines for children. There's family service information centers at many of the courts in Ontario. So there are resources that the government is putting money into this area, because it is so expensive, the administration of justice. So I see that there is money going into it. It's just the question of how do we educate our citizenry to understand that the licensing of parenting, being a parent, well, it's not really a license, being a parent is an assumption in our society. It's not even a privilege. So how do we educate adults to understand better their responsibilities in respect of children? Or I would say it this way. How do we educate those who are over 18 to understand that those under 18 have a voice and need to be heard?
Right. Are there any groups that are heard more or heard less from groups of children, I mean? Like, is family income related to how much the child's rights are advocated for?
No, I think in respect of what we are talking, I think it just goes across economic and it goes across ethnic classes. I think some of the very wealthy do a very good job of ensuring that their children aren't heard. And in fact, the momentum of money allows the debate or the battle to go on independent of hearing from the child for sometimes even a longer period of time.
Right. So I guess being able to go to court will cause those damages that court causes.
That's right. The an interesting issue that, of course, that this dialogue, this discussion we're having raises is, when do we in our law or in the community in general, when do we decide that we're going to hear from the child and hear the child's voice and give the child the opportunity to be heard? Now, usually what happens is, because we're so cynical and skeptical about what has happened in this area, when the parents have had lawyers, we worry that the last thing we want is for the child to participate in this proceeding and for the child to have a lawyer, because we say, oh my goodness, we have two parents, now we're going to have two lawyers, now we're going to have three lawyers. If there's three kids, maybe we'll have six lawyers. And that may be a field day for the lawyers, but it won't be of much help for the resolution of the dispute.
And maybe they're worried that the involving the children would be damaging itself.
That's right. And that's correct. And there's a sense that the farther away the child is from the court, so to speak, from the battlefield, the better. I think we're going to have to revisit that sooner than later, especially with respect to 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, 13-year-olds, who are very aware, very sensitive, and who, when these disputes are going on, if they're not heard, if they're not taken seriously or allowed to say what they want so that we know their preferences no differently than we know the parents, then that in and of itself can lead to a sense of disenfranchisement that leads to a sense of, well, I guess I'm not worth it.
Right. So there aren't enough safeguards in place to make sure that the rights of children are being considered in talks and in litigation?
Well, not only, yes, that's true, but more so than that, there's a general sense in our community right now that we can make a lot of decisions in these kinds of disputes about which we discuss, that is, where parents are in conflict with one another without hearing from the child, that in fact it's in the best interest of the child that we don't hear from the child. In certain situations, we even have lawyers who go to court who say that this is what the child wants, but this is what I think is in the child's best interest. So concerned, so much do we have the concern that maybe it's not good for a child's wishes to be told. And then we have experts going to court from your field, from the field of sciences, who say, well, why would we listen to an adolescent? Because words to the effect their brains are under construction and they really don't know what's in their best interests. So there is a shift going on today, similar to years ago, where we called it tough love, where there's a sense that, no, we don't want to hear from you in the course of these disputes. It'll cause more harm than help. And I'm probably out there saying, no, I don't think that's a good idea. We should hear from them.
Right. What happens in the case of siblings when there's multiple children involved? Are they a source of strength or resilience when they can go through this together?
Well, the empirical literature, the articles written in this area suggest that when there's conflict facing a family, then it is better to keep the children together than to separate them.
And it's associated with better outcomes, I guess, for the children.
Better outcomes? I'm not so sure. I say that's been the general presumption, general trend of the writings. In the work that I've done, I'm increasingly seeing cases where we could sort out the dispute if one of the children was with one parent and the other child was with the other parent. Now, as odd as that sounds, or it seems that it's a separation of the siblings, in many instances, one child has a better relationship with one parent than they have with the other. But I would argue, you know what, if it buys peace, then the passage of time combined with peace is more important than keeping the two children together.
Right. Is it largely up to the children, though? Who's making this decision?
Who's making the decision?
Of where the children go, whether the siblings get split up or whether they both go with one parent?
That would be if the parents resolve matters cooperatively, then they would make the decision. If they don't resolve it cooperatively, then an arbitrator or a judge would make the decision.
What does the phrase parental alienation refer to?
Well, that's a pretty interesting question. Parental alienation is it refers to the notion that one parent has irrationally alienated a child against another parent, and it is the latest of what I call the voodoo sciences that sometimes infiltrate the law, and science seduces the law to think, well, here's the answer, and if you just find one parent to be the parental alienator, then that finding or that diagnosis, as it's called, will allow for a cure, because then we can deprogram or expose the child who is parental alienated to an intervention, a clinical intervention, that will rid the family of this awful cancer.
And so, in your experience, it's not quite how it happens, or?
That's in my experience, there's never one cause for the problem, and it's like, I'd say 30, 40 years ago, people believed that learning disabilities was causally connected to young people committing crimes, until someone said, well, that's more a correlation than a causal connection. And here I would argue it's simplistic to assert that the notion of parental alienation, and in my work, where the youth are of an age like 13, 14, 15, to approach the matter on the basis that one parent only bears all the responsibility or even the primary responsibility for the dysfunction is to perpetuate the problem, because it will break down. It won't work.
So do you think this parental alienation thing is a distraction or is just naive?
No, I think parental alienation, it's somewhat of a philosophical question, but I think parental alienation is every once in a while in the work that we do, family lawyers or society at large, someone comes along with a notion that sounds scientific or sounds, and they present it as science. You know, that's what happened in the case of parental alienation. It goes back to the writings of one psychiatrist, and it's been taken up by psychologists in America, and they have an intervention program that costs a remarkable amount of money. So science comes along, or the advocates come along, and they say to the family law industry, or the conflict industry, we have the answer, or we can tell you how to diagnose the problem and how to cure it. And judges, or the law, is taken or seduced by the notion of a panacea to the problem. And so it embraces it and experiences it, and then years go by. We're not at that point yet in parental alienation, but I'm prepared to venture the judgment that in a few years' time we will see that those who advocate this, it doesn't hold up in science, and it's not going to hold up experientially. That is, we'll see the number of cases where dealing with the family in this way has caused more harm than help.
Do you think that that science is being used not sort of in an evidence-based way? So by presenting this, they're not really looking at outcomes, but rather ideas that are sort of substantiated in a non-real but a scientifically explainable way?
Yes. I mean, you and your audience are better tuned to the meaning of science in many ways than I am, but with what I know, yes, the answer is yes. This is not scientifically based.
Is this a general problem in law, that science can be used out of context? Or
it is a general problem, yes, that experts come before the court, and you can be an expert and you can sound of science, but you're not necessarily doing the work that you're doing in a manner that might make the grade scientifically. Now we're becoming much more circumspect in the law to the whole idea of an expert. But in the area of parental alienation, for example, all of the evidence, what I'm going to call, I'll use the word evidence, even though it's suspect, it's all anecdotal. It is, I'm going to tell you stories of 20 cases or 23 or 25 where we intervened, and by labeling a parent an alienator and by doing what we did, we solved the problem. If in fact they did, because there's the absence of longitudinal research about what happened years later. So it's just a glimpse, so that's one problem. Secondly, we don't know what it is they did that led to the result. And we don't know if it's a function of parental alienation. We've given it a label. But the label itself isn't one that is capable of any predictability. So it's what I call voodoo science. It's just something that's attractive to many judges and many people who want another cause or another way to explain the difficulties that exist within families.
Yeah. So we were talking about before how the rights of children may not be considered in cases. But what happens at your workshop, The Law and Youth? I think you're emphasizing the importance of knowledge and how that empowers children.
So at the workshop, this is our fifth annual workshop, and we target any youth in the community. And they meet up with some caring judges of the courts in Ontario, and they meet up with lawyers and with some other individuals who have gone through some pretty awful or difficult times in their childhood and yet have emerged. And the primary purpose of the Law and Youth Workshop is to enable the youth to find a voice and how to responsibly speak when they are engaged in the law. And hopefully to learn from the judges what it is that they can do for their voice to be better heard, and also for the youth to hear from the judges, to hear from the youth about what it is that they're not doing, that is, those who are robed in power, in terms of listening to youth. So it's very interactive, it's free, and it attracts about 100 to 150 youth from really all parts of the community, from youth who are in residential facilities to youth who are in high schools, and we meet at the University of Toronto, the Faculty of Law, for one day.
When's that occurring this year?
That's occurring on Friday, February 25th, but you can only come if you're under 18, and you have to pre-register. And you can pre-register by going to www.thelawandyouth.org, and there's a space there where you can register. And there's no cost, and if I can say, lunch is free, so it's a good thing to come.
Should youth be worried about losing their anonymity if they decided to participate?
Well, that's a great question. If they were that concerned, then they can just use initials or make up initials, but still they must register because we have to have a sense of the numbers. And when they meet in the seminars in the program, confidentiality reigns because they meet with a lawyer, and at the very beginning of the program we explain that here's a place where you can say really anything you want to say to the person with whom you're speaking, because we want people to talk about their problems. We don't want them to keep them inside, because that's part of connecting to your voice.
Great. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today, Mr. Wilson.
Okay, well, thank you.
We reached Jeffrey Wilson by telephone from Toronto, Ontario. For more information about the Law and Youth Workshop, you can visit www.thelawandyouth.org. I'm Eric Brown, and Nikki Bosnoff is on the board. As always, you can listen to previous episodes of our show at www.healthjusticeradio.wordpress.com. Thank you for listening to Health Justice Radio on CFMU 93.3.